Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And, you know, we got Paul back with us. And I think that they're really covering the details regarding paper money, gold, and so forth. And as a matter of fact, because of the digital currency and everything going live, I hope everybody understands how there's a huge difference between something that has a tangible value and something that does not. And so what is the tangible value of digital currency?
Well, you know what? If you don't have any electricity, it's nothing, right?
What's its value?
It's nothing. You're just digits.
That's right. Okay? It's just arbitrary.
Right.
Right.
Okay.
Right. So even with the Bitcoin and so forth, unless it's something that you're holding in your hand, it doesn't exist.
Right.
It exists maybe somewhere for somebody else, especially if you take gold in your hand and you deposit that into a system. However you do that, by transferring money, you put it into your bank, and then that bank basically takes that and basically transmits it into Bitcoin or what have you. As you do that transaction, now they have that. You no longer have access to that. If everything went away tomorrow, that is what you lost.
Right. That is correct.
That is correct. So even as things appreciate, it's kind of like, you know, my house is worth $1 million. Let's just say my house is worth $1 million. Well, it's only worth $1 million in a perspective. It isn't worth $1 million until somebody comes along and lays $1 million down for it.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
The Zillow may say your house is worth this much, and somebody may pay that much. But if your house is actually worth more than what Zillow was quantifying, because can you sell a house well over Zillow's estimate? Absolutely. Especially if that house is everything that other person wants and is willing to pay that price, then that's what it's worth for that person. I mean, when I sold my home in California, we sold it well above the market value, well above.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we took a loss on it. But anyway, all that being said, I'm ready to get moving forward. But one of the things we didn't connect on is, you know, where we wanted to kind of start off with again. And I think that it would be good to start off with at the commencement of the war, because that kind of starts off with a good starting point. And that's at the very bottom of the page of, you know, that section. So, in other words, we're at the very end of the last area of paper money.
Okay, so we were doing paper money with Mr. McClain.
That is correct.
And if you look at where we left off.
Okay, but I'd like to start off with at the commencement. I think that's a little bit before where you left off. In other words, you're going to repeat a little bit just so that it makes kind of – it ties it together a little better, because it starts off with at the commencement of the war.
All right. Is it a few years before the late – I'm looking for at the commencement of the war.
And it's at the very bottom. It's like five lines up, and it starts off at the right side.
All right. So
– okay. Sorry, folks, for this, this coordination problem.
So I'm looking at the paragraph, and I say a few years before the late war. It's not that. The Merchants of Great Britain, it was somewhere before that.
Okay, so it's just above the line. and it would be five lines up. It may be four or five lines, or actually six, seven lines up. I don't know, for you, because...
Okay. All right. And it starts at the commencement of the war?
Yeah, at the commencement of the war, our paper money in circulation was gold, was equal to gold or silver. And you know what? Instead of just doing the struggling, I will just read this.
I found it.
Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead.
Sorry. At the commencement of the war, our paper money in circulation was equal to gold or silver. But it is said that on adoption, all debts contracted heretofore must be paid in gold or silver coin. I believe that if any gentleman will attend to the clause above recited, he will find that it has no retrospective but a prospective view. It does not look back but forward. It does not destroy the paper money which is now actually made, but prevents us from making any more. This is much in our favor, because we may pay in the money we contracted for, or such as is equal in value to it, and the very restriction against an increase of it will add to its value. It is in the power of the legislature to establish a scale of depreciation to fix the value of it. There is nothing against this in the Constitution. On the contrary, it favors it. I should be much injured if it was really to be the case that the paper money should sink. After the Constitution was adopted, I should think myself, as a holder of our paper money, possessed of continental security. I'm convinced our money will be good money, and if I was to speculate in anything, I would in paper money, though I never did speculate. I should be satisfied that I should make a profit. Why say that the state security will be paid in gold and silver after all these things are considered? Every real actual debt of the state ought to be discharged in real and not nominal value at any rate.
Okay, so he's making an interesting point, but it took them, well, actually, the Treasury Act of 1792, it took them that long to finally get there to where they could start minting. So, in other words, the states were still kind of using paper money and so forth. But let me ask you this. How much do you think a dollar, a North Carolina dollar bill, is worth today?
I don't know that it's worth anything today.
I'd probably say it would be, I'd venture to say it's probably worth $1 million.
Wait a minute. Help me understand.
Because there's so few of them that the collectors of that script, how many are out there in circulation? Zero.
Right.
And so how much is some of these really rare coins? I mean, when all of a sudden they become obsolete, in other words, they're not printing them anymore, they're not doing it anymore, you know, he's right. The value of these things actually start to go up.
Right.
Because it was worth something, and it's an exchangeable thing in some market, and over time, you know, it's kind of like a brand new car. You buy a brand new car, it instantly depreciates. Mm-hmm. And then over time, and the money is not necessarily like a brand new car at all, but my point is that you can get to a point, you know, after 20, 30, 50 years,
yes,
if there's a high desirability of that car could be worth millions.
Right. Yeah, okay.
And so it's to the collector that would pay $1 million. It's not whether it's worth $1 million in currency. I mean, you couldn't lay that thing down and say, I want to pay for these groceries with it.
Mm-hmm.
But to the right person, the value of that money has gone up dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's worth a lot more than the script itself.
Right.
Okay. That's the point he's kind of making, because once they end it, they're not making any more. And this is how it actually starts acquiring value, because eventually, you know, how many times, you know, do you know people that have, you know, mercury dimes? I mean, what's a mercury dime worth? It's worth a lot more than 10 cents, just because, yeah, one, it's silver, And two, because it's collectible. I mean, there's only so many of those in circulation. So when they stop making them, they, you know, their value shoots up. And they, and one of the things that an advantage, because in our old coin currency, if I remember correctly, the silver ratio in a silver coin was about 90%. Today, okay, the silver coins are 99.99999. Mm-hmm. In other words, the purity of the silver is incredible today. Mm-hmm. Now, you know what? I'm going down a rat hole. So let me stop myself right here, because I was going to just go down this path of, you know, what it takes to do that, and, you know, why the value should be actually going up. But that goes all down to the fact that we're not even, there's no association to that silver coin and that silver dollar, or from the silver dollar to a paper dollar in your wallet. I mean, they're not equal at all.
They're not. There's no, yeah, there's no relationship.
Correct. Absolutely. No relationship whatsoever. And so, okay, Mr. McLean made his comment. Now, Mr. Iredell is going to actually make a comment regarding the, a short comment regarding slavery, but the comment afterwards is really what I think is really important, because out of all of the ratification debates, how many times did you hear them talk about an Article 5 convention?
I don't know that
we've talked about it at all yet. In other words, here it finally comes up.
Okay.
Right? So remember I mentioned that, you know, there's certain issues that, you know, only came up in one state or another state or what have you. This happens to be one of those issues. This is an outlier. I think there were talks about amendments and those types of things, but not a convention. So anyway, let's go ahead and see what he says about slaves.
So Mr. Iredell begged Lee to explain the reason of this clause. In which clauses? Oh, the fourth article, section one, first two clauses. Okay. Mr. Iredell begged Lee to explain the reason for this clause. In some of the northern states, they have emancipated all of their slaves. If any of our slaves, said he, go there and remain there a certain time, they would, by the present laws, be entitled to their freedom.
Okay, hold on.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
In some of the northern states, not all of them, but in some of the northern states, they have emancipated all their slaves.
Right.
So do you think America was a slave state? I mean, the Constitution hadn't been ratified. Was America a slave nation at that point in time?
Of course not.
But no, hold on here. Hold on here. I'm hearing from historians, from the kids today that are reading the accurate history, that America was a slave nation.
America was composed of several states.
No, I get that.
Themselves,
I get that. Okay. No, but the point I'm making is how the revisionists of history clearly misrepresent the truth about what was really happening at the forming of the Constitution, and how America really went down this path of having very limited slavery. And it says right here, in some of the northern states, they have emancipated all their slaves.
Right.
So it is a snapshot to actually say, hey, hold on here. The United States was not a nation of slaves.
Correct.
That each state had its own course, and most all of the northern states, because we've already read this too, that most all the northern states are actually on the way of getting rid of all of their slaves. They were abolishing slavery. So that's the point I wanted to make here, because the ratification debates is clearly, so let me ask you this. Do you think Mr. Iredell had an axe to grind or some narrative in trying to misrepresent history at this point in time regarding, you know, the future generations to read this?
No,
not
he
at
was
all.
There.
Absolutely. And so he was speaking as a matter of fact.
Right.
Okay. This is how, and this is why the ratification debates can actually give you a clear picture. I mean, if we had a photography, you know, because You know, I used to sell audio equipment and so forth, and I remember talking about how important it is to have the truth, you know, the real thing, because music is the recreation. You know, when you're reproducing music on a stereo or what have you, you're recreating the performance right there in front of you. And if the intent is to recreate that instead of making it sound the way you want it by using a lot of filtering, I want to boop, you know, increase the bass, I want to increase the highs and cut out the mid and change the sound, then you, then this is all subjective based on your desires of how you like to hear music. You don't want to necessarily hear the artists themselves, like the symphony, orchestra, jazz band, rock and roll, whatever. Whatever right. the performance is, how they did it. And so high fidelity is recreating that performance to the T. So, you know, regardless of the failures of the recording equipment and the, you know, the audio equipment playing the back, you know, you want to get as close as you possibly can that the recording will allow you. So I use this in a similitude, or I use it metaphorically. I speak in the terms of a painting. If you and I went to Mount Everest to paint that painting, you know, and we're standing there in the streets of Kathmandu and we're painting it, are you going to include all of the details of the litter in the street, or are you going to not include that? Because, see, as a painter, you have the subjectivity of how you want to present that. Mm-hmm. But if you have a photograph, there's no hiding the truth.
Right.
And the ratification debates, to me, is a photograph of history. Mm-hmm. Because there was no need. These guys were putting it all on the line. There was no need whatsoever to filter anything. Mm-hmm. There was no subjectivity applicable here. And that's what's really important, that we can actually look and use the ratification debates as a source document to give us a very accurate picture of what was going on in America at the time. Like Pine Barren laws. Mm-hmm. You know, those types of things. I've never heard those, and we've read through these, but
right.
I've never looked them up, and we've never been taught these things. So
right.
Anyway. I just wanted to make this one moment of clarity as we kind of read these things to go, oh, wow. You know, there is such insight when we read these documents very specifically, because these men were not speaking for future generations to actually derive some narrative or to twist something for their advantage. Mm-hmm. That's what revisionists do.
Right.
Okay.
So what makes this, that makes this a treasure.
Absolutely.
Okay. Because it's been, it's not only been hidden, maybe it's been protected. And now it's time for this thing to come out and be understood. So, sure. So you ready for me to read this?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm sorry for going down that rat hole, but I thought it was important.
No, that's okay.
Okay.
Mr. Iredell begged Lee to explain the reasons for this clause. Oh, we read that. In some of the northern states, they've emancipated all their slaves. If any of our slaves said he'd go there and remain there a certain time, they would, by the present laws, be entitled to their freedom so that their masters could not get them again. This would be extremely prejudicial to the inhabitants of the southern states, and to prevent it, this clause is inserted in the Constitution. Though the word slave is not mentioned, this is the meaning of it. The northern delegates, owing to their particular scruples on the subject of slavery, did not choose the word slave to be mentioned. So, yeah, you know, we just had this discussion, but I guess what's saying here is that the Constitution provided for that the northern states got, you know, abolished slavery. But if a slave from the South escaped to a northern state, I guess they were required to be extradited. Is that right?
Right. Yep.
Okay.
Because that's what the Constitution dictated, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
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 All right. So we are now, I guess Mr. Iredell's continuing and he's changing the subject. He's talking about Article 5, right?
Right.
Okay. Here we go. Mr. Chairman, this is a very important clause. In every other constitution of government that I have ever heard of, no provision is made for necessary amendments. The misfortune attending most constitutions which have been deliberately formed has been that those who formed them thought their wisdom equal to all possible contingencies and that there could be no error in what they did. The gentlemen who framed this constitution thought with much more diffidence of their capacities, and undoubtedly without a provision for amendment, it would have been more justly liable to objection, and the characters of its framers would have appeared much less meritorious. This indeed is one of the greatest beauties of the system, and should strongly recommend it to every candid mind. The constitution of any government which cannot be regularly amended when its defects are experienced reduces the people to this dilemma. They must either submit to its oppressions or bring about amendments more or less by a civil war. Happy this, the country we live in. The constitution before us, if it be adopted, can be altered with as much regularity and as little confusion as any act of assembly. Not indeed quite so easily, which would be extremely impolitic, but it is a most happy circumstance that there is a remedy in the system itself for its own fallibility, so that alterations can without difficulty be made agreeable to the general sense of the people. Let us attend to the manner in which amendments may be made. The proposition for amendments may arise from Congress itself, when 2/3 of both houses shall deem it necessary. If they should not, and yet amendments be generally wished for by the people, 2/3 of the legislatures of the different states may require a general convention for the purpose, in which case Congress are under the necessity of convening one. Any amendments which either Congress shall propose or which shall be proposed by such general convention are afterwards to be submitted to the legislatures of the different states or conventions called for that purpose. As Congress shall think proper, and upon the ratification of 3/4 of the states, will become a part of the Constitution. By referring this business to the legislatures, expense would be saved, and in general, it may be presumed they would speak the genuine sense of the people. It may, however, on some occasions be better to consult an immediate delegation for that special purpose. This is therefore left discretionary. It is highly probable that amendments agreed to in either of these methods would be conducive to the public welfare when so large a majority of the states consented to them. And in one of these modes, amendments that are now wished for may in a short time be made to this constitution by the states adopting it.
Okay.
It is.
All right. So we're a couple of minutes out from a break. And so clearly he's kind of going through the mechanics of a convention. And so, and the whole point of, and you got to remember, folks, that in the Articles of Confederation, you know, an amendment was a unicorn. Right? I mean, how they had all of these different amendments. Obtaining that amendment was like attaining a unicorn.
Okay.
Because it was almost impossible. It didn't exist. They were unable to amend the Articles of Confederation.
Right.
And they understood the dangers of all of that. So, you know, we're literally at about 1 minute, you know, down. And so there, I don't want to necessarily go into the rest of this before
come out of the group.
Right. So. Any ideas or any comments before we go into break that you have on what you've read so far?
No, not yet. I think it will be interesting when we get to the rest of it, but not right now.
Okay, because this is a hot debate. I mean, right now I look at the articles or the convention of state folks out there that are literally, you know, misleading everybody to getting people to believe that the only mechanism we have to our avail, you know, to dealing with government overreach is the Article 5 Convention. And so bottom line, here we go, Paul. We're heading right into the break right now. And so what I want to do is we can talk a little bit about this convention or what they're trying to assert as the only mechanism of holding government in check or accountable. I'd like to kind of bring that up because You know, near as I can tell, it is the improper method of putting government into check regarding overreach and so forth. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so, Paul, clearly in this Constitution, prior to the Bill of Rights and anything and everything else, what was the methodology baked into the Constitution of holding our public servants accountable?
Prior to the Constitution?
No. So in the new Constitution...
Right.
Not prior to, but under this new Constitution, prior to the Bill of Rights, prior to any of the amendments at all, you know, because the Constitution was ratified. The very first session was, you know, the federal government was flying on just the Constitution without a Bill of Rights.
Right.
Okay.
Well, it would be, to me, their oath or affirmation.
Yes, precisely. Precisely. Okay. As a matter of fact, that's what really sold this to Monroe and others. You know, hey, at least these guys are under oath.
Right.
That we can hold them liable for in perjury for taking an oath and doing something that actually violated that oath. That was huge. No government had had that. And so here, go ahead.
Here's a question. Now, this is so it was a long time before Article Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. How did they propose to enforce that?
Well, at that point in time, there was the integrity and the honor of a man. I mean, you couldn't go home. I mean, people would probably sling, you know, bad things at you, right? Cow patties or what have you, right? Roadside apples at you, you know, for being a bad person, but. You know, the things changed. All of a sudden, everybody lied. Everybody was doing it.
Right.
Right. And so there was the need to do more, but how long was it for the First Amendment to actually be a part of the Constitution? So now all of a sudden we had the oath, and now we had the First Amendment petition to hold public servants accountable. I mean, a direct mechanism in the Constitution to hold government accountable. So why is it that the Convention of States, you know, get away with lying to everybody saying, hey, you know, this is the only mechanism of putting, you know, a check on federal government. Are you kidding me?
Right.
And the federal government really isn't the problem. It's the states that are the problem because the states aren't holding the federal government accountable. Anyway.
Nor the people.
I get that.
Yeah.
I get that. So let's go ahead and you pick up now with the hot stuff here.
Here we go. So we are going to COS, right?
Yeah.
This is Mr. Airedale still.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
It should be, it is however observed, to be observed?
Okay. It is however to be observed. I'm sorry, I lost my place. Because I read the first part. Uh-huh. I read the yellow highlighting, right?
Yep.
Okay. See, the Constitution, any government. Oh, there we go. It is, however, to be observed So the first and fourth clauses in the ninth section of the first article are protected from any alteration till the year 1808. And in order that no consolidation should take place, it is provided that no state shall, by any amendment or alteration, be ever deprived of equal suffrage in the Senate without its consent.
Okay, that's so hold on here. He's clarifying this, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
There you go. Okay. So, in other words, he's covering what we refer to, but, you know, go and Google the guarantee clause. Go and Google the due process or lector's clause. You know, and you'll find that in law, they have actually, you know, I'll just say they've galvanized that, or they've, you know, inscribed that into their law as very specific clauses. Mm-hmm. Now, a long time ago, I started referring to this as the Amendment Protection Clause. If you Google that, you'll find that that does not fall under anything. I mean, nobody, it's never been established as an amendment. In other words, all of these people that have created this, what we call this mystical constitutional law, completely have omitted this part.
You talk about Google the guarantee clause?
No. Yeah. So if you actually Google the guarantee clause, you'll actually get an output. You know, oh well, this clause deals with this part of the Constitution. Well, show me where there is any clause that they ingrained into what they call constitutional law for this clause, what I call the Amendment Protection Clause. And you'll find, so the fact of the matter is, you'll find nothing. If you put that clause, if you type that clause out in Google and you put it out there, it'll only come back as just a part of the Constitution. They've never identified this as what we call what I call an Amendment Protection Clause. In other words, this Constitution is protected from any kind of amendment to actually take this away.
Right. Okay.
So in other words, how is it that the 17th Amendment was ever created and accepted unless people didn't realize that they couldn't create that amendment?
Right.
And if they did create that amendment, no state was bound to it if they didn't consent.
Whoa. Because, and in fact, the point he seems to be making here is that that isn't even amendable.
That's, you know, right.
The states cannot be denied, deprived of their equal suffrage in the Senate without their consent. And so, you know, apparently the 17th Amendment was sloppily and hastily done.
Well, okay, so it's not only sloppily and hastily done, it was sloppily and hastily handled by the states, you know, as everybody just kind of accepted it and rubber stamped. Or not one state stood up and said, this is a direct violation of Article 5. What my point is constitutional illiteracy was so rampant. And you know, there were lots of things in the Constitution people didn't understand. But if this one little thing didn't slap people in the face and say, hold on here, you can't even make an amendment to do that.
Right.
At least you couldn't apply that amendment to any state that did not, ratify it. If they rejected it, they couldn't be held to it. And so today, why is Utah and the other six states in the union that have not accepted this, have not given consent, why is it that they're following the 17th Amendment? Clearly, by law, they're not obligated.
Right. They're constitutionally illiterate.
Right. Well, that's what we've been doing.
Whoa.
Right.
Whoa.
So, folks, if you know anybody from Utah that happens to be a part of the Utah State Legislature, you know anybody that claims to be smart on the Constitution, ask them, why is it that they're still following the 17th Amendment? Have they not, by this point in time, has not anybody in the state of Utah or the state of Georgia or Florida, these other states that never gave their consent? I'm not just going to pick on Utah. All seven of these states, and I could look it up. I don't have it. It's actually in my article on rescinding the 17th Amendment. But folks, if you know anybody from these seven states, it's time to start harassing them and make them feel like fools. Because right. It seems like that's the only way we can get through to them to understand that they cannot lose their suffrage.
Correct.
I want people to understand that, you know, when you look at elections, how much money is involved? And who makes that
billions.
Money?
Billions.
Who makes that money? Advertising companies.
Right.
Broadcasting companies. I mean, people that run ads, advertising. I mean, look at how much money go through the economy just because of an election. You know what? If these people had their way, there'd be a national election every year.
Mm-hmm.
Because it makes them money. There yes. are some companies that literally, you know, hang by a string financially until the next election. Or they actually shut down and they open up again when the next election comes. That's the kind of money that, you know, people go, wow, you know, I want a piece of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just wrong. I mean, back in the framers' days, an election brought no money. It was a bit of a burden, and it was a civil burden that everybody mm-hmm. carried. And it's, right. instead today, you know, we laugh about, you know, ambulance chasers, right? But there's not, there's something to be said for election chasers, too.
Election chasers.
Yeah. Anyway, I've digressed. I just wanted to make a real salient point on, you know, this whole concept of, you know, Article 5 and how it, go ahead, the first two prohibitions with respect and all of that.
Okay. The first two prohibitions are with respect to the census according to which direct taxes are imposed, and with respect to the importation of slaves. As to the first, it must be observed that there is a material difference between the northern and southern states. The northern states have been much longer settled and are much fuller of people than the southern, but have not land in equal proportion nor scarcely any slaves. The subject of this article was regulated with great difficulty and by a spirit of concession which it would not be prudent to disturb for a good many years. In 20 years, there will probably be a great alteration, and then the subject may be reconsidered with less difficulty and greater coolness. In the meantime, the compromise was upon the best footing that could be obtained. A compromise likely took place in regard to the importation of slaves. It is probable that all the members reprobated this human traffic, but those of South Carolina and Georgia would not consent to an immediate prohibition of it. One reason of which was that during the last war, they lost a vast number of Negroes, which loss they wished to supply. In the meantime, it's left to the states to admit or prohibit the importation, and Congress may impose a limited duty upon it. You want me to continue reading?
No. So, actually, go ahead, because Mr. Bass then gets up and says, he observed.
Yeah, Mr. Bass observed that it was plain that the introduction of amendments depended altogether on Congress.
Right.
And then Mr. Iredell replied that it was very evident that it did not depend on the will of Congress, for that the legislatures of 2/3 of the states were authorized to make application for calling a convention to propose amendments, and on such application it is provided that Congress shall call such a convention so that they will have no option.
Right. So in other words, they're batting it back and forth, and so a guy gets up and says, well, you know, we're still submitted to the federal government because it depends upon them that they have to call it. And he goes, actually, no, they are obligated to call it if 2/3, you know, submit for a convention. And then it goes on down to, then they read Article 6, the first clause, then the second clause, which is what we were talking about, the real check in holding government accountable. So go ahead with that, the supremacy clause.
All right. Mr. Iredell still. So now this clause they're talking about, is this the...
Article 6.
Okay. This clause is supposed to give too much power when, in fact, it only provides for the execution of those powers which are already given in the foregoing articles. What does it say? That, quote, this Constitution and the laws of the United States which shall be made in pursuance thereof, and all treaties made or which shall be made under the authority of the United States shall be the supreme law of the land, and the judges of in every state shall be bound thereby, anything in the Constitution or laws of any state to the contrary notwithstanding, end quote. What is the meaning of this but that as we have given power, we will support the execution of it? We should act like children to give power and deny the legality of executing it. Oh, we should act like children to give power and then deny the legality of executing it. It is saying no more than that. When we adopt the government, we will maintain and obey it in the same manner as if the Constitution of this state had said that when a law is passed in conformity to it, we must obey that law. Would this be objected to? Then when Congress passes a law consistent with the Constitution, it is to be binding on the people. If Congress, under pretense of executing one power, should in fact usurp another, they will violate the Constitution. I presume, therefore, that this explanation, which appears to me the plainest in the world, will be entirely satisfactory to the committee. You want me to continue? There's a lot going on.
Yeah, here. Keep going. Right? Yeah, that's the precise. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, Mr. Bloodworth. Mr. Chairman, I confess his explanation is not satisfactory to me. I wish the gentleman had gone farther. I readily agree that it is giving them no more power than to execute their laws. But how far does this go? It appears to me to sweep off all the constitutions of the states. It is a total repeal of every act and constitution of the states. The judges are sworn to uphold it. It will reproduce and abolish abolition of state governments as sovereignty absolutely annihilates him. Where is he going with this?
Well, so the guy is trying to make a point that says that because everybody is going to be held to an oath to support this federal constitution, that it will actually abolish all of the states because they're legally obligated to support the... He's making hay out of nothing because they're only to support those limited powers. The question is, you know, when this guy says this, and I hope Mr. Iredell then finally, you know, backhands him in his following comment. I'm not sure if he does, but he should basically say, okay, hold on here. You're saying that the supremacy clause opens this door for them to, you know, usurp all of the states and control everybody. Where is that power granted in this Constitution? Remember, this is an enumerated Constitution. That power is not granted. This is only an unnecessary execution of the powers that are granted. Where are you coming up with the fact that this will actually take away, you know, the state's authority and the responsibility of supporting the state by its laws?
All right. Right. So Mr. Iredell responds, before I do that, how many minutes do we have left?
We have 9 minutes left.
Oh, great. Okay. Mr. Chairman, every power delegated to Congress is to be executed by laws made for that purpose. It is necessary to particularize the powers intended to be given in the Constitution as having no existence before, but after having enumerated what we give up, it follows, of course, that whatever is done by virtue of that authority is legal without any new authority or power. The question then under this clause will always be whether Congress has exceeded its authority. If it has not exceeded it, we must obey, otherwise not. This Constitution, when adopted, will become a part of our state constitution, and the latter must yield to the former only in those cases where power is given to it.
There you go. Only in those cases. That's correct. Keep going.
Okay. It is not to yield to it any other case, whatever. For instance, there is nothing in the Constitution of this state establishing the authority of a federal court. Yet the federal court, when established, will be as constitutional as a superior court is now under our Constitution. It appears to me merely a general clause, the amount of which is that when they pass an act, if it be in the execution of a power given by the Constitution, it shall be binding on the people, otherwise not. As to the sufficiency or extent of the power, that is another consideration and has been discussed before. So Mr. Bloodworth responds. Oh, this is paper money. So we're
He brings up another issue, right? So he's changing the topic. Go ahead.
Okay. This clause will be the destruction of every law which will come in competition with the laws of the United States. Those laws and regulations which have been or shall be made in this state must be destroyed by it. If they come in competition with the powers of Congress.
Yeah.
Okay. Be destroyed by it. Come in competition with the powers of Congress. Is it not necessary to define the extent of its operation? Is not the force of our tender laws destroyed by it? The worthy gentleman from Wilmington has endeavored to obviate the objection as to the Constitution's destroying the credit of our paper money and paying debts in coin, but unsatisfactorily to me. A man assigns by legal action a bond to a man in another state. Could that bond be paid by money? I know it is very easy to be wrong. I am conscious of being frequently so. I endeavor to be open to conviction. This clause seems to me too general, and I think its extent ought to be limited and defined, should suppose every reasonable man would think some amendments to it were necessary.
There you
Mr.
go.
McLean. Okay.
Uh-huh. Keep going.
Mr. McLean responds. Mr. Chairman, that it will destroy the state sovereignty is a very popular argument. I beg leave to have the attention of the committee. Government is formed for the happiness and prosperity of the people at large. The powers given it are for their own good. We have found by several years' experience that government taken by itself nominally, without adequate power, is not sufficient to promote their prosperity. Sufficient powers must be given to it. The powers to be given the general government are proposed to be withdrawn from the authority of the state governments in order to protect and secure the union at large. This proposal is made to the people. No man shall deny their authority to delegate powers and recall them in all free countries. But says the gentleman last up, the construction of the Constitution is in the power of Congress, and it will destroy the sovereignty of the state governments. It may be justifiably said that it diminishes the power of the state legislatures, and the diminution is necessary to the safety and prosperity of the people. But it may be fairly said that the members of the general government, the president, senators, and representatives, whom we send thither by our free suffrages to consult our common interest, will not wish to destroy the state government, because the existence of the general government will depend on the state governments. By what is the sovereignty and who is Congress? One branch, the people at large, and the other branch, the states by their representatives. Do people fear the delegation of power to themselves, to their own representatives? But he objects that the laws of the Union are to be the supreme laws of the land. Is it not proper that their laws should be the laws of the land and paramount to those of any particular state? Or is it proper that the laws of any particular state should control the laws of the United States? Shall a part control the whole? To permit the local laws of any state to control the laws of the Union would be to give the general government no powers at all. If the judges are not to be bound by it, the powers of Congress will be nugatory. What is that word? Nugatory?
The powers would be negative.
Yeah, okay.
Okay.
This is self-evident and plain. Bring it home to every understanding. It is so clear it will force itself upon it. The worthy gentleman says, in contradiction to what I have observed, that the clause which restrains the states from emitting paper money, etc., will operate upon the present circulating paper money, and that gold and silver must pay paper contracts. The clause cannot possibly have a retrospective view. It cannot affect the existing currency in any manner, except to enhance its value by the prohibition of future emissions. it is contrary to the universal principles of jurisprudence that a law or a constitution should have a retrospective operation, unless it be expressly provided that it shall. Does he deny the power of the legislature to fix a scale of depreciation as a criterion to regulate contracts made for depreciated money? As to the question he has put of an assigned bond, I answer that it can be paid with paper money. For this reason, the assignee can be in no better situation than the assigner. If it be regularly transferred, it will appear what person had the bond originally, and the present possessor can recover nothing but what the original holder of it could. Another reason which may be urged is that the federal courts could have no cognizance of such a unit. Those courts have no jurisdiction in cases of debt between citizens of the same state. The assessor, being a citizen of the same state with the debtor, and assigning to it to a citizen of another state, to avoid the intent of the Constitution, the assignee can derive no advantage from the assignment except what the assigner had a right to, and consequently, the gentleman's objection falls to the ground. It's a mouthful, GR.
Yeah, it is.
Okay. All right. Every gentleman must see the necessity for the laws of the Union to be paramount to those of the separate states, and that the powers given to by this Constitution must be executed. What shall we ratify a government and then say it shall not operate? This would be the same as not to ratify. As to the amendments, the best characters in the country and those whom I most highly esteem wish for amendments. Some parts of it are not organized to my wish, but I apprehend no danger from the structure of the government. One gentleman, Mr. Bass, said he thought it neither necessary nor proper. For my part, I think it essential to our very existence as a nation and our happiness and prosperity as a free people. The men who composed it were men of great abilities and various minds. They carried their knowledge with them. It is the result not only of great wisdom and mutual reflection, but of, quote, mutual deference and concession, end quote. It has trifling faults, but they are not dangerous. Yet at the same time, I declare that if gentlemen propose amendments, if they be not such as would destroy the government entirely, there is not a single member here more willing to agree to them than myself.
Yeah, okay, so we got 1 minute. And so there was a lot that, you know, there's mouthfuls. I mean, you know, head explosions when you really start looking at a lot of the different things that they basically were refuting these little comments that, you know, well, I have a problem with this government because it, you know, it has these powers to basically subjugate the states. Where is that? It's not in that Constitution because they read this general clause. Now, what ended up happening is that Marshall used the Supremacy Clause to say whatever we decide is final and it is the supreme law. Bottom line, if they decide something that they have no authority to do, it can't be the supreme law. But Marshall basically started, and the states hoodwinked him. In other words, they go, oh, okay.
The statehood with Marshall.
Yes, they did. But we're out of time. We'll have to bring that up tomorrow. So I've got making a note right now, folks. The states hoodwinked Marshall in a way they did. And I'll explain this in our next episode. This way you'll have clarity as to how it all went down and how all of these things started working against our liberty instead of for our liberty. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google Donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to ReclaimingTheRepublic.org and go to the contributions page, and you can become a listed supporter of liberty.